Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Did you have your Wheaties this morning? If not, what did you eat for breakfast? And do you know when it came from and when it all started? We're going to find out today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, I'm Linda Palaccio, your host on A Taste of the Past here on Heritage Radio Network. It is a member-supported network and the cutting-edge source for all the information on food, sustainability, gardening practices, farm practices, cooking issues, and, of course, culinary history. And I mentioned Wheaties and breakfast. One of our hosts, Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues and the founder of the Museum of Food and Drink, recently held a happening, if you will. He constructed and found an old cereal gun. You ever wonder how they got puffed wheat and puffed rice? Well, Dave figured it out, and he has this beautiful, huge contraption. And it publicly fired off the gun and popped all kinds of grains and showed how cereal actually was made in that puffed manner, for those who didn't know. Quite an event. And it explained a lot to people about how they got that cereal in their bowl. But before there was cereal in their bowl, there were all kinds of breakfasts all around the world, all throughout the ages. And an author has written a wonderful book about it called Breakfast History, and she is Heather Arndt Anderson. Heather is an author, well, she was formerly a plant ecologist, and she's an author and historian. And Heather, I welcome you to the show, and this is most interesting.
Thanks, Linda. Thanks for having me on.
The book really covers covers quite a bit of time and territory, and I find, of course, the ancient history myself, I find that really very intriguing. And yet again, it's not all that different, is it?
No, it's not. That was one of the most fascinating discoveries I made while I was doing research for this book, is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And largely, foods have not changed at all in thousands of years.
Well, In a few thousand words, can you give us sort of a condensed chronology of, as far as we know from written record, like how breakfast has evolved?
Well, beginning in the Paleolithic era, humans started processing grains, and I hate to make a jab at all of my friends who are on the paleo diet, but sorry, friends, humans have been eating processed and grains and baked goods since the Paleolithic era, based on modern archaeological evidence that has been substantiated. So for thousands of years, things pretty much stay the same. In the classical antiquity, people were still eating porridges, not so much for breakfast. There was a lot of flatbreads, olives, figs, grapes, that kind of thing, and that still sort of goes on in the Mediterranean and the Middle East today.
Well, so I'm sorry to interrupt, because we, you know, think about the word breakfast. I mean, they're breaking the fast. Obviously, you know, you sleep for however many hours, and you have to break the fast to get energy for the following day. And this word is pretty much been, in many different languages, the similar kind of meaning, correct?
Yeah, and you know, I'm not sure if cultures that were later to develop written language, if they had any specific concept of breaking the fast, or if they just didn't give much thought to it. They woke up, they were hungry, they had work to do, and so they ate something and didn't spend much time worrying about it. The Greeks and Romans, of course, worried and thought about everything and spent lots of time waxing poetic about every single...
Philosophizing.
So I'm not sure if everyone spent as much time thinking about it as Westerners did.
So
that was outside the scope.
So you talked about grains. Grains had been consumed. And, in fact, you mentioned that there was more, nothing had quite the effect on the evolution of the human as the domestication of grains.
Yeah, and that's a point that has been driven home by lots of authors. But as Harold McGee said, it is difficult to overestimate the importance of grain on human evolution. And that is a paraphrasing of what he said. But once humans domesticated grains, that was a pretty big game changer. We had a little bit more time to develop art and culture, basically. So everything that is good about humans or everything that makes us human is really because of grain, in my opinion. Cereal is the basis of all of humanity. The sedentism really did give us a chance to spend time on other endeavors, things besides surviving, and that had, you know, wide sweeping effects on all of culture and humanity.
What else aside from grain domestication really affected that first meal of breakfast and what was eaten?
Well, I think that there are lots of factors, but I think that convenience is really one of the major players, because people didn't have time, especially before electricity, people didn't have time to spend on preparing lengthy and elaborate foods. People with household staffs later, of course, had people to do cooking for them. But people needed to be able to eat something that was fast. And so that's why we see a lot of things like cheeses and fruits and breads or leftover meats from the dinner the night before. It was really just a grab-and-go kind of meal. And that is a trend that has maintained through modern times. People don't really have time to spend cooking in the morning, or they don't want to, especially when you have just a little bit of daylight to get your work done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned olives, and that made me, of course, think of ancient Roman times. And we know that there's written evidence from Pliny and others that breakfast was consumed in antiquity. What would have been what do we know was eaten or consumed for that first meal in ancient Roman times?
Well, there was a dish. It was, you know, Ariston was the name of the morning meal, but another word for it was akratisma, and that came after the word akratos, which is the morning wine. And normally, the ancient Greeks and Romans too drank their wine diluted, and it was considered very boorish to drink straight, undiluted wine. But the very first meal of the day was bread dipped in the undiluted wine, and it was considered by some to be a sort of grace for the day, so as an offering to the gods. It wasn't really meant to be drunk, but typically bread dipped in wine was a pretty common thing to start your day with back in Pliny's day. And then, like I said before, the olives and figs and other flatbreads. But, yeah, usually it was just nothing more than a simple bread dunked in wine.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because they gruel and pour it back to grains again. Can't get away from those grains. And it's funny because ancient grains have, you know, are so much in the news today and kind of back in fashion. But gruels and porridges and a pulse, of course, at Roman time they would have had like a pulse. They appear in just about every culture throughout time.
Yeah, they really do. And at every meal also until, you know, we get to today's times where porridge is not really eaten for dinner. But, yeah, grain, gruels, and even gruels made of legumes and pulses are eaten throughout the world for breakfast in varying consistencies and varying flavor profiles. In Africa, they have a lot of millet and maize-based porridges that probably haven't been changed much in millennia. In Eastern Europe, they have other kinds of porridges made with barley, and you know, throughout Europe, Northern Europe, there are rye and oat porridges and wheat porridges, oatmeal, of course, and being Scottish, it's almost a Scottish national dish.
Right.
yeah, well, oats.
In your research, I mean, you did cover some, as you say, some of the practices in Africa and certainly Asia. And well, tell us a little bit about the kanjis and the Asian culture.
Oh, kanjis and jukes are really interesting because, well, they still eat them today. And in different parts of Asia, you can get different ingredients. You know, in China, you might get a preserved egg to add to your, or a little bit of fish to add to your juke. And then in Vietnam, you get a little bit more offal. But, yeah, and depending on the region, you also have varying degrees of, I'm not sure what, viscosity, I guess, is the word. Mm. If the more broken up the rice grains are, the more creamy the juke will be, more custardy. And then there are also different, gosh, I wish I had a better way to explain this. The better the cook was, the way the Chinese considered, if your cook was really good, then the grains would not be all mushy. They would be perfectly cooked. And I lack the language to describe it because it's in Chinese. But, yeah, and in Southeast Asia, they stick to rice. But in China, they will also use grains like millet and wheat, depending on how far north they are. Mm-hmm. In Japan, they have other kanjis, like a rice porridge, that have written mention that go back centuries.
Interesting. And as I said, you cover Africa, and of course, then you've just told us some about the Asian experiences with breakfast. But you really do focus mostly on the Western world. Is there a reason for that? Were there more changes? What?
Well, the focus is on the U.S. and England by proxy, because that the subject is just too large to cover the whole world in the amount of tale that I am obsessed with, but also the scope of the series was really intended to be for the West.
Uh-huh.
And yeah.
Well, certainly certain things happened throughout history that altered breakfast as we know it, religion being one of them. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, of course, religion has had wide sweeping effects on many parts of Western culture. I guess that's stating the obvious. But early on in the Middle Ages, breakfast was considered by some members of the Catholic Church to be a type of gluttony because it was eating too soon after one's prior meal. So there were six different kinds of gluttony one could commit, and breakfast was closest to the one of eating too soon. And certain people still ate anyways because they really did need the calories to do their work, or because they were, you know, infants. You can't starve an infant in the morning, the elderly and the infirm. But religion had kind of a stronghold on the acceptability of eating breakfast for a long time. And then in the 16th or the 17th century, when Europe got a taste of chocolate, the Catholic Church actually made a concession to allow chocolate during the fasting periods by saying that liquid does not break the fast, and so people were able to enjoy chocolate when they were supposed to be fasting. And then again, so after things settled down a little bit and breakfast is sort of back on the docket for most people, things get kind of kooky again in the 19th century with the Seventh-day Adventists. And I don't spend a lot of time talking about the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the book just because, you know, it was a rabbit hole that I didn't want to spend too much time on.
Yeah.
But with the players like Sylvester Graham and James Caleb Jackson, and those guys that were really the forerunners of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we get the serials kind of making a big comeback. Sylvester Graham, of course, is the father of the Graham flour, Graham crackers. He invented some cereals or ways of eating cereal, and James Caleb Jackson invented the first sort of ready-made cereal. Unfortunately, it was really hard, and people called it wheat rocks because you'd have to soak it overnight before you could even chew it. And so the convenience factor was pretty much nil in a product you had to soak overnight. And then, so the Kellogg boys come into play. They are also, of course, pretty famous Seventh-day Adventists. And the Seventh-day Adventist Church was invented in Battle Creek, Michigan, which is where the Kellogg brothers were living and had their sanitarium. Is it okay if I jump right into talking about the Kellogg?
Absolutely.
So the Kellogg brothers had this sanitarium in Battle Creek, and they were looking for a product that would be easy to chew because, you know, Jackson had invented the granula, but it was hard as a rock. And since a lot of their clientele were sort of, they were the social elite, but a lot of them were also sort of on the older age bracket. And so they had a hard time chewing those really dense wheat and graham products. So the Jackson guys were cooking something up, and they got called away from the kitchen for a minute. When they got back, their pot of mush had gone stale and dried out, but there was so much product on the stove they didn't want to just throw it away. So they decided to try rolling it through some steel rollers to get some kind of sheets that so they could cut it up and use it, and it flaked up because it was just so dry. And so they served it to their clientele anyways. And people loved it. They just, fortunately, the people really liked it. Later, of course, things got a little sticky between the brothers because corn, you know, goes rancid pretty quickly. It's high fat content. And so the younger Kellogg, Will, decided to start adding sugar. And, of course, John Harvey Kellogg, that was anathema to everything he stood for.
Against the health movement, right?
So, yeah, these health-crazed Seventh-day Adventists really changed the breakfast table. They were anti-meat, anti-caffeine, anti, you know, other human pleasures. but they really promoted this grain-heavy vegetarian diet, and I think that that had a really big impact on the American breakfast table, and I think that that is responsible for breakfast cereal being the major player of the breakfast table today.
Indeed. I mean, what would, you know, what would half of the population do without their box of Wheaties or, you know, cornflakes or puffed rice? Well, you mentioned corn, in fact, and maize and the planting of corn in by the Mesoamerican Indians. I mean, that whole and the whole science of learning how to turn corn into hominy and frying it. I mean, that changed the world of breakfast tremendously right there.
Oh, yeah. The Mesoamericans had been tinkering with the genome of corn for millennia, starting with the nubby little grass, teosinte. And I can't imagine what would inspire somebody to take this spiny little ugly grass and say, hey, I wonder if I can eat that. But I guess desperate times call for desperate measures. But yeah, over time, they were able to get a grass with a really big flower, basically, and develop corn. And I'm not sure how the nixtamalization process was developed, but thank goodness it was, because it really frees up the niacin in the corn grain, which prevents pellagra and other nutritional deficiency diseases. And the technique was, of course, it was developed in Mesoamerica, but it came north all the way to North America, to the Great Plains Indians, who still use a similar process today using wood ash. to wash the indigestible hull off of the outside of the corn grain.
Right, and then and that frees up the nutrients, as you said.
Right, and so with the maize products like masa and stuff, we have tamales, which are not a breakfast food, but the corn mushes and corn meals became a real staple of American Indians and then also early American settlers.
Right, and then and from there, then we get things like hoe cakes and Johnny cakes and things that we eat today still.
Yeah, grits.
All right. What about the appearance of dairy and eggs, you know, yogurts, cheese? Well, you mentioned some cheeses before, but other dairy and eggs on the breakfast table?
Well, dairy and eggs have been eaten, you know, since the Neolithic. I mean, they've always been foods for humans. Dairy products, I think, because dairy and eggs dairy specifically, you know, you milk a cow in the morning, and so it makes sense to have some dairy in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And cheeses are a product that can just be kept around. You don't need to do much to prepare them. And in a lot of parts of Northern Europe, they still do just eat a slice of bread with cheese, like an open-faced sandwich. Yogurt was developed in Central Asia, probably by accident, just like all good things, when some milk was being kept in probably like a goat skin, and bacteria just curdled the milk into a nice product. I think that those are just staple foods, that they're a good source of protein. They're inexpensive and easy. Once you have, you know, cheese, you don't have to do anything. It's just you slice it off or break it off and have it with bread, and there you are.
Mm.
And eggs, too, since chickens are so easy to keep, nowadays you can get eggs year-round, but you know, back in the day, you only got eggs from about spring until fall, and then chickens take a break in the winter. They stop laying. But eggs are a pretty reliable source of protein. And so I think that, well, gosh, in the Renaissance, egg cookery was really a big deal. I mean, they found new spectacular ways to cook eggs. There were hundreds of ways to cook eggs in the Renaissance. But a lot of times you could just throw them in the embers of your dying fire, and then they'd be cooked the next morning, and that was a really convenient way to have eggs for breakfast.
And we do sort of relegate them to the breakfast table. Well, we're going to talk more about this and about some popular breakfast drinks when we come back after a short break.
I want to put you in a cloud and push you around. I want to put you in a cloud. I want to put you in a big white cloud, push you around.
This song is called 10,000 Breakfasts with You by Cookies, and you're listening to A Taste of the Past on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
We're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm speaking with Heather Arndt Anderson, the author of Breakfast, A History. And Heather, you mentioned something about wine, the consumption of wine in ancient Roman times, but the consumption of alcohol continued as far as a breakfast drink for quite some time until other things came on the onto the picture.
Yeah, and even overlapping caffeinated beverages. Benjamin Franklin complained that one of his co-workers was having beer before breakfast, beer during the morning break, beer at lunch. Because of the the poor water quality during the Middle Ages and just beyond that, early modern era. Small beer, which was a diluted beer, just like the diluted wine of the ancient Greeks, was pretty much the beverage of choice for the breakfast table. Queen Elizabeth was a fan of ale and beer, two separate beverages at the breakfast table, along with her oat cakes and beef. And, of course, today we still have our breakfast cocktails. You know, people love their Bloody Marys.
Bloody Marys, yes. Right. A brunch wouldn't be complete without it, right? Then tea came onto the well, coffee first. Chocolate, right. When did all that change?
Well, okay, so in the late 16th century, early 17th century, chocolate, tea, and coffee, just a little bit later, all became introduced to Europe from their various sources. So chocolate comes from Mesoamerica, along with the New World foods like tomatoes, corn, and potatoes. From Asia, we start getting China through trade, and then coffee makes its way from Northern Africa, Ethiopia. So all of these wonderful beverages start showing up in Europe right around the same time, and I can't imagine how overjoyed the Europeans must have been to have all of these brand new, delicious, energizing products just showing up in the markets. And of course, it's not that everybody could afford it. It was still for the upper crust for about 100 years. But it was such a game changer. Caffeine obviously has the opposite effects as alcohol on one's productivity. And so I think that there just must have been a wide sweeping effects on the way Europeans conducted their business.
Right,
for a while, the caffeinated beverages were for the afternoon tea. It was more like a treat. But by the 18th century, they really were just a solid part of the morning.
Yeah, well, and I think it's safe to say that caffeine outweighs alcohol as a breakfast drink today. it's held its own. Right. What about did you notice any specific differences? I know in America, even, that it's a matter of taste, but throughout different cultures in your research, did you find a real difference between savory and sweet as far as preferred breakfasts?
Yeah, I think that it is really a cultural difference. In America, we get more mixing of sweet and savory than I think that you'd see anywhere else in the world. In Western Europe, like France and Italy, you get things like just little breads with maybe some jam or chocolate. In Northern Europe, you get more bread with cheese and meat. And then Eastern Europe, it's, you know, the same kind of thing, the meats and cheeses and pickles. And I don't think in Asia anyone would consider a sweet, besides fruit, to be something that you would eat for breakfast. But in America, we get these kind of bonkers combinations, like chicken and waffles with syrup on them. A lot of the honey with your meat. And I guess that sort of harkens back to the medieval era when they were using sweet spices and honeys with their savory dishes. But for breakfast, it seems a uniquely American thing to have sweet and savory together.
Neither do I. and it's interesting because we, you know, not in our culture so much, we don't find like a big bowl of a savory stew being served. I mean, unless it's leftovers from, you know, and you're hungry and you open your refrigerator and there's that, leftover stew. But generally that maybe would be saved for a later meal. But it's not uncommon in other cultures, I'm sure.
Right. That's the other sort of uniquely American phenomenon, is to not have soup or stew for breakfast. And even just North America, I mean, in Mexico, they have menudo. That's a very common breakfast, and that menudo takes a long time to cook, and so I think that it has to be a leftover kind of food,
or put the pot on the night before, and there you have it. Well, certainly the practice of taking breakfast out, coming with boarding, you mentioned trade, the growth of trade, so then all of a sudden there were these traveling salesmen or, you know, people traveling for work. So there were boarding houses, right? B&Bs. The practice of taking breakfast out became an industry in itself.
Yeah, even before the Industrial Revolution introduced the middle class and the sort of the work day as we have it today, where you get up at a certain time, you go to work, the work day starts at 9. Even before that, there were traveling breakfast sellers like in Burma, the Mohinga sellers who would sell you the catfish stew. And there were breakfast stalls in Victorian era in England, so you could get your little bread roll on your way to your own workspace. And so taking breakfast on the go has been around for kind of a long time, and it really has maintained today. There's, you know, the birth of the breakfast sandwiches and drive-thrus in the 60s and 70s. And eating breakfast in boarding houses and bed and breakfasts, for guys who had to work away from home, especially out west in the frontier, it was such an important industry for a lot of working women and also families who just needed extra income to open their homes to these bachelors, these wayward guys who needed to have some breakfast before heading off to work for the day.
Well, certainly breakfast in America has kind of morphed into the ultimate comfort food. And we have breakfast diners, waffle houses, and pancake houses. And truly it is a comfort food. You think of, you know, biscuits and gravy and pancakes and
You're making me hungry.
I know. Well, and just I posted a picture of waffles. I think it's something you might have had on the show page for this show. And we looked at it. We were sitting in the studio and looking at it, and all of us started to get hungry. I mean, who doesn't love great breakfast food? Well, it is truly an intriguing read, a very interesting read, too. And the book is, again, Breakfast, A History by Heather Arndt Anderson. Heather, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your information.
Thank you, Linda.
Right. Again, you've been listening to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network, and I want to remind all of you once again that Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported network, and we hope that you will visit our homepage and consider joining if you like this program and many more. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.